Do you see what I think I see in the thick dust?
Where?
What? There on the floor. Leading from the door straight across the room to within a yard of Manton's body.
Footprints. Bare feet. Three parallel lines of them. This is awful. A woman's footprints in the center and on either side the marks of children's feet. Look at that. This nearest print of the woman's foot. The middle toe is missing. The middle toe of the right foot. Gertrude. My sister Gertrude.
From the time-worn pages of the past, we have brought you the story, The Middle Toe of the Right Foot. Bellkeeper, toll the bell!
Tonight's presentation brings to a close the present series of Weird Circle stories at the Ogden's Playhouse. For the past 39 weeks, we've brought you the great mystery classics by the world's master storytellers with the thought that in the entertainment offered, you would find enjoyment. If the presentation of this Weird Circle series has attained that objective, Ogden's feels that the purpose of the series has been met. Till we meet again, then, here's a reminder. Try Ogden's Fine Cut Tobacco. You'll find Ogden's easy to roll, delightful to smoke. Yes, easy to roll, delightful to smoke. If you smoke a pipe, try Ogden's Cut Plug. It's a smooth, mellow pipe tobacco.
Of the past, we have heard another immortal tale in The Weird Circle. Bellkeeper, toll the bell. Be here in this lonely cave by the restless sea once again next time. circle. In this cave by the restless sea, we are met to call from out of the past stories, strange and weird. Bellkeeper, toll the bell so that all may know we are gathered again in the Weird Circle.
Once again, it's Weird Circle time at the Ogden's Playhouse. Tonight, we are to hear an adaptation of the Ambrose Bierce story, Middle Toe of the Right Foot. To the mystery story fan, tonight's presentation promises keen listening pleasure. To the smoker who rolls his own cigarettes, Ogden's Fine Cut promises smooth smoking pleasure. It's a promise that comes true with every cigarette rolled with Ogden's. That's why we call attention to our standing invitation to try Ogden's when in need of a cigarette tobacco. You'll find Ogden's easy to roll, delightful to smoke. Yes, easy to roll, delightful to smoke. And now the Ambrose Bierce story, The Middle Toe of the Right Foot.
Mansion place, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a run-down farm. Weeds growing rank all over and the house rotting away.
Yeah.
Do you think anyone will show up to claim it tomorrow?
Gertrude Manton's brother's been notified. That house has been empty now for 10 years.
You think Manton will show up?
I wish he would. Manton killed his wife and children there.
Well, what happened to this fellow Manton?
I don't know. Never found a trace of him yet.
And you, a deputy sheriff? Better shine up your badge and get busy.
Well, I'll find the murderer someday. Somehow.
Well, no wonder the ghosts live there. It gives me the creeps. Now, look, even the trees are all leaning to windward, trying to get away. Come on, let's drive on.
All right. Come on. Yeah, Ross will be waiting at the hotel. We better get along.
Why don't you look where you're going?
Why, I'm sorry. I was only...
Get out of my way. People are the clumsiest. Clerk.
Good day, sir.
I want a room.
Yes, sir. Gladly. Will you sign the register? Front! You will have room 212, Mr. Grossmith.
Oh, Mr. Grossmith, I think we've met, sir.
What?
A bumping acquaintance in the screen door just now.
Well,
Allow me to introduce myself. Ross, sir, editor of the Marshall Advocate. Glad to welcome you to our city. Are you here on business?
If I am, it's my own business.
My mistake, stranger. What a horned toad.
Rosser, here we are.
Hello, King. Oh, you must be Mr. Sanchez.
Yes, sir.
How do you do, sir? Welcome to Marshall.
It's good of you to meet us here, Mr. Rosser. We county politicians, like the deputy here and myself, can't get along without you great men of the press.
Oh, sure. Come on over here and sit down.
That's right.
Now, you want to talk about the Manton house first or the coroner?
Oh, wait a minute. First, let's order something long and cold, huh? The Manton place will take care of itself.
It's a good idea. That was a hot drive. Well, now, about this candidate for coroner, Rosser.
I can't see, King, why a man can't be a good coroner just because he's got a cast in his eye.
Well, you know, Rosser, I have a theory that any physical defect goes with some mental or moral defect. Just can't help myself. I hate and always hated any kind of deformity in a man or in a woman.
I infer then, Mr. King, that a lady lacking the advantage of a nose would find it a hard struggle to become Mrs. Thomas King.
Well, put it that way if you want, but seriously, I once nearly married a most charming girl who... Well, I was a kid lawyer studying at Harrison. Each time I came home here, I rushed over to the Brewers. I think I was really in love with Gertrude Brewer. She was lovely. Then, one summer afternoon, we were in the orchard. Her young brother was helping us gather fruit.
Oh, Tom, it's such fun to have you home. Even if for only these short visits. How's everything?
Oh, just fine and dandy. Oh, I've so much to tell you. They made me deputy sheriff.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah. Can't I see you alone this evening? Let's walk down to the river.
Oh, I'd love to, Tom.
Sis!
What is it, Ned?
Here comes Matt. He's tying up his team down by the gate.
Oh, Gertrude, I can't stand that man. Why do you let him come here?
Why, he's very amusing, Tom, and very nice.
He's very prosperous. But I agree with Tom, sis. He's a queer duck. Got queer ways.
Well, Ned, what do you mean?
Well, I went after Partridge with him, and he uses the craziest contraption.
Yeah? How's that?
He's taken a long, straight branch, stripped it, and on the end he's fastened a loop of wire that's sharp as a razor blade.
A razor blade?
Yeah. He sneaks up on a bird, then gets the loop over its head, and gives a quick jerk. And presto, bird's dead. Throat cut.
Mm.
Oh, Ned, why does he do that?
Well, there's no shot to scare other birds.
Well, that's true, and a good idea if you want slaughter instead of sport.
And when he's doing it, Tom, his eyes look so queer.
Oh, Ned, here he comes. But I'll see you alone tonight, won't I, Gertrude, dear?
Yes, Tom, of course.
Afternoon, Miss Gertrude.
Hello, Mr. Madden.
Just thought I'd stop by to see the prettiest peach in the county.
Oh.
Hello, Ned, my boy.
Howdy, Mr. Manton.
Why, Mr. Manton, look. Your hands are stained.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, Miss Gertrude. I have been doing a pretty job of butchering. Finest calves you ever saw.
Oh. This is our friend, Tom King. He's been made deputy sheriff.
Oh, good old law and order. Well, howdy.
Don't you ever take your cattle to market on the hoof?
I'll prefer it my way. Besides, it makes for tenderer, whiter veal. Well, young woman, you look mighty near perfect today.
Mighty near? I think Gertrude looks perfect always.
Well said, young sheriff. I guess by and large that everyone will agree that Miss Brewer here is an absolutely perfect specimen. No flaws, no faults.
Now stop it, both of you.
Well, as her brother, I'll say she's easy on the eyes, but a perfect specimen? Ha ha. No, she isn't.
Now, Ned, behave.
Ned, what are you talking about?
Yeah, you tell him, sis.
Oh, the boy's crazy. What's he driving at?
Well, it's all so silly. I don't know why Ned mentioned it, but the fact is, if you must know, I have only four toes on my right foot. No middle toe.
What?
Cut off by accident?
No, I was born that way.
Oh, a branded filly, eh? Well, you'll never stray from your owner, will you?
Gertrude, I never knew that.
Why, it's of no importance, Tom. I never think of it.
Ah, it's cool here under the trees. Mind if I sit on the bench?
Oh, not at all, Mr. Manton. Here, I'll make room.
Take my chair, Manton. I'll be running along.
Oh, Tom, already?
Yes, I've got some business in town. Important, really. You'll excuse me, Gertrude. So long, Ned.
Forgetting me, eh?
No. Goodbye, Mr. Manton.
Oh, see you tonight, Tom. Goodbye for a little while.
Well, gentlemen, I didn't go back that night, and that goodbye was not for a little while, but for a long time.
Do you mean a defect in the young woman's foot made such a difference to you, King?
Yes. It's a curious obsession on my part, but I know that if I'd married that girl, I should have been miserable and would have made her so.
And if the girl cared for you...
She couldn't have cared too much for King, for she soon married a gentleman with more normal views.
You mean Manton? I get it. That horrible house we passed today. But you said Manton killed his wife.
Yes, he did. Hey, wait a minute. Who's that coming out of the door? It's familiar looking. Oh, but it couldn't be.
His name's, Grossmith.
Grossmith, huh?
Yeah. A cheerful bounder if I ever met one. Nearly knocked me down when he arrived this afternoon.
Hmm.
Bit my ear off when I tried to speak to him.
Well, no interview?
No interview. What a nerve. He's sitting down right near us.
Well, I'm interested in this story of King's.
Tell me more about the Manton case, King.
Your friend seems to be choking.
Let him choke. Go on, King.
Well, there's not much more to tell. I spent several years in the county seat before I came back here. The next time I saw Gertrude Manton was one day 10 years ago. I was in my office when I heard a knock on the door. Come in.
Tom, it's I, Gertrude Brewer. Gertrude Manton.
Gertrude! Oh, it's good to see you again. Why, you look...
Don't try to be polite. I look old and tired and scared. And I am.
Well, what is it? Here, sit down and tell me. Tell me how I can help you.
Will you help? Ned's away and I'm in such trouble.
Well, I've heard gossip that things aren't going so well at the farm.
They're not. It's awful. There are no more cattle.
No more cattle? Well, in heaven's name, why?
My husband's killed them all. He cut their throat.
Oh.
It's just sort of a passion with him. There were no more calves, so we killed our bull. Then he started on the cows. Our lovely, gentle cows. Every so often, my husband's eyes get a strange, glassy look in them. He whets his slaughtering knife and sort of fingers it with an awful smile on his lips. Hmm. Tommy's crazy. He ought to be put away, but... What must I do?
Oh, now, Gertrude, dear, of course I'll help you. Take it easy. Now, don't cry.
I won't, but... Tom, he cut the throat of our last cow yesterday. I'm so frightened. It's having a terrible effect on the children.
Now, see here. Everything will come out all right. Please stop crying. I'm going to get Dr. Carter, and we'll drive out first thing in the morning.
You will?
Yes.
Oh, that's wonderful. I won't be afraid anymore. Thank you, Tom. We'll see you tomorrow morning, then. Goodbye.
It's good of you, Dr. Carter, to drive out here. Ms. Manton's an old friend of mine.
Well, she's a fine woman, Tom. Oh, but that husband.
Yeah. Doc, I want you to look him over. There's something very wrong.
Oh, Nellie. Oh. Oh. Oh, lovely sunset. A lovely day out. What a gloomy place this is.
Hello, Gertrude. Gertrude! She doesn't answer.
Well, let's ring or knock or something.
I'll try the bell.
Look here, Tom. The door's open.
Now, go on in. Gertrude, where are you?
This house has the emptiest feeling. Are you sure she knew we were coming?
Well, we arranged it only yesterday. Oh, she must be here.
There's no one in this room.
Well, let's go upstairs.
Yes, you'd better. Come on.
Doc, wait. Look, here on the stairs. This stain, it's sticky.
It's blood. Dripping from... Hurry, Tom, hurry up here. Good Lord. Little boy lying by the banister.
Oh, his throat is cut. Gertrude! Gertrude! Where the devil is she? Doc, try the bedroom door.
Tom. In here. It's Mrs. Manton, lying across the body of her little girl. Both their throats slit from ear to ear.
As tonight's Weird Circle tale unfolds, many of you will note a familiar ring to the style of plot structure used by the master storyteller Ambrose Bierce, the incisive, racy style of the modern writer. Written before the First Great War, the middle toe of the right foot still carries the modern touch. In short, the works of good writers live on through the years. It's the same with Ogden's Fine Cut Tobacco. A long time back, when Ogden's first came into prominence as the top choice of roll-your-own cigarette fans, smokers were talking about and praising Ogden's. Today, just as then, Ogden's remains the popular choice of Canadian roll-your-own cigarette smokers, a fact that can be attributed only to unvarying excellence right down through the years. Try Ogden's for real smoking enjoyment. You'll agree Ogden's is easy to roll, delightful to smoke. Yes, easy to roll, delightful to smoke. And now back to our story. Sheriff Tom King, years ago, had been attracted to Gertrude Brewer, but ended his courtship when he learned that she lacked a middle toe on her right foot. She soon married the well-to-do but eccentric Robert Manton. This marriage ended in tragedy, for several years later, the town was horror-stricken to learn that Manton, in a frenzy, had cut the throats of his wife and of their two children. Manton escaped. The house has been empty for 10 years.
That's the story of the Manton murders. And a morning I'll never forget.
Well, I don't wonder. It's a horrible story. Tom, you may be interested to know that this Grossmith, or whatever his name is, sitting near us here, has been glaring at you and taking in every word you said.
Why the impudence? What do you think we ought to do about it?
That's easy. Sir, I think it would be better if you'd remove yourself to the other end of the veranda. You are evidently not used to the company of gentlemen.
I'll not be spoken to that way.
Why, you ill-bred lout. You've listened to every word we've been saying.
Now, easy, Rosser. You're a bit hasty and unjust. This gentleman's done nothing to deserve such language.
I'll not take back a word. This man has been annoying me all day.
Hold that tongue of yours, sir, and I'll cut it out.
You will you?
Rosser, yes, please. Hit him, then. It's the custom of the country to demand satisfaction for an unwarranted blow. I now demand it of you.
I'll give it gladly.
I have no acquaintance in this place. Perhaps you, sir, will be kind enough to represent me in this matter.
You mean me? Well, I don't especially like your manner or your manners, but I suppose I shall have to consent. My name is Sancher. Yours is Grossmith, I believe.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Sancher.
And you, King, will act for me, of course. What's the matter? What are you staring at?
He's looking at me, and I find it most objectionable. Why do you look at me like that, Mr. King?
I find you very interesting, sir. You're giving me an idea.
Oh, I've had quite enough of this. Get on with the arrangements, Mr. Sancher.
Very well, sir. I'll toss a coin. As challenger, Mr. Grossmith has first call. If he wins, he may choose either the weapons to be used or the spot where the affair is to take place.
Right. Satisfactory, gentlemen.
Toss the coin.
Here goes. What do you say, Grossmith?
Heads.
Heads it is.
Then I've got my choice of weapons.
Yes. What do you want, guns?
Certainly not. Knives. Boy knives, and I insist that it be a duel in the dark with knives.
Knives. I thought so. You like knives, don't you, Mr. Grossmith?
Now hold it, Tom. It's up to Rosser to say where this duel's to be.
Well,
I'll speak for you, Rosser. As your second, it is my privilege to make the arrangements.
All right with me, King.
Well, then, gentlemen, meet me here in 3 hours.
Right.
It'll be dark then, and I shall drive you to the place I have chosen for this strange encounter.
Mr. Sancher, I depend on you to buy the longest knives you can find in this town. I'll be here at 9 o'clock. But for now, I've had enough of you gentlemen's company.
Look here, Tom. What the devil have I got myself into?
A duel. A duel with knives. And, just as he says, in the dark.
But I didn't bargain to get ourselves into a mess like this.
You realize that we have the choice of place, don't you? Well, don't worry. Nothing's going to happen to you, Rosser.
Well, as second to this fellow Grossmith, I must ask you, King, what's your planning? Is it some sort of practical joke?
Not exactly a joke, Sancher.
Well, where is this place you have in mind?
A rather appropriate spot. Remember the haunted house I showed you today?
You mean where the Manton murders were?
Exactly. It will be the most perfect setting. And now, if you and Rosser will only help me carry out my plan tonight when we get to that Manton house, this is what will happen.
All right, here we are.
Come on, get out, Grossmith. This is the place. What are you waiting for?
By heaven, this is a trick.
Well, of course, Mr. Grossmith, if you're afraid of spooks... Why...
I'm afraid of nothing. I'm coming.
The choice of place for this duel was ours, Mr. Grossmith, and we have chosen this house. Go in, please.
Boy, it's dark as Hades.
Well, here, wait a minute. I've got a candle. I'll light it. There. That's better. Now, here's the room.
The dust is a foot thick.
Yeah, these infernal cobwebs. They're like rotting cheesecloth.
Come, gentlemen, I'll hold the candle high so you can look into the room. It is large and square, as you see. No fireplace, no furniture. Only this door and two windows, which are boarded up. It will be utterly dark. Mr. Sancher, is everything all right?
I think the gentlemen should remove their hats, coats, and vests.
All right, but I don't see the sense to it.
Shall we leave them here in the passage?
Yes.
Very well. And now, gentlemen, here are the knives. They are exactly alike. You may examine them by the candlelight, and while you do so, I shall search you, Mr. Rosser. Nothing. Now, let me hold the candle, King, while you search my principal.
Right. Well, I'm satisfied. Well, Sancher, I think we're ready. If it is agreeable to you, Mr. Grossmith, will you place yourself in that corner, the one farthest from this doorway?
Well, I can't see a thing.
Feel your way along the wall. And now, Rosser, you here in this corner nearest the door.
Right.
Now, gentlemen, you are both in position. Remember, you are not to start fighting or move until you hear the closing of the outer door. I shall now blow out the candle. There is the darkness you asked for, Grossmith. We leave you now. Good luck, Rosser. Goodbye, Mr. Grossmith.
Are you with us, Rosser? Right behind you. Then here goes the outer door.
All right, Rosser. Come out of that corner. My knife is waiting for you. My knife. I love a knife. I'll carve you up, you blackguard. Well, why don't you say something? Rosser, where are you? Come out of that corner. Very well, I'll get you. Are you a sniveling fool? Are you afraid? Oh, corner. But I'm getting nearer to you, Rosser. Why don't you move? The door. Now. There's no one here. Rosser, where are you? I'll get you. Rosser, speak. And I can't hear a thing. No footsteps. He's not in here. By heaven, I've been tricked. I'm alone. Alone in this house. What's that? Oh, I'm cold. It's getting cold in here. Oh. Oh, that glow of light. And who's there? No. You. You, not you. Not all three of you. No. Oh, go away from me. Stop. Don't come any nearer. No.
Come in.
What's the big idea of sending for me so early in the morning? Oh, hello, Sancho.
Hello.
Did he get you here, too?
Yes, he did. Well, Tom, what is it you want?
Boys, that hoax we framed up last night doesn't look so good this morning.
What do you mean?
It's got me in a spot. You see, there's something about that fellow Grossmith I didn't tell you in Sancho. I drove right back to the house after I left you boys last night, and though I called and yelled at him, there wasn't a sound. He wasn't there. And he didn't come back to the hotel.
Well, what do you care? I never want to see the fellow again.
But I've got to find him.
Well,
I never should have let him get away.
Just what do you mean by that, Tom?
Well, I mean just this. When Grossmith challenged you, I thought I recognized him. Yeah. That fellow isn't Grossmith at all.
Huh?
He really is...
Hello, Tom. I guess I'm early.
Ned Brewer. Well, I didn't expect you here this early.
Well, I got tired waiting for you and the county commissioner.
I'm glad to see you again, Ned. You know Sam Rosser, the advocate?
Of course. How do you do?
Welcome back, Ned.
And this is the commissioner, Mr. Sancher.
Glad to meet you, sir.
How do you do?
I'm Gertrude Manton's brother.
I guess so. Well, Mr. Brewer, the county will be glad to give over the custody of the farm, and since you're here, we might as well drive right out there and get the business over with. What do you say, Tom?
Sure. I'd like it mighty well if Rosser here came along as a witness. Well,
why not? Of course. Make a good feature story for my paper. But I bet it'll bring back powerful, unpleasant memories to you, Brewer. To see that Manton place again.
I wish I didn't have to come out here. This place drives me crazy. Such ghastly recollections. I can't ever forget that day.
No, nor can I, Ned. It was stark horror. Unbelievable.
Poor Gertrude. What happens now, Mr. Sancher?
Well, we wait here till noon. It's nearly that now.
Good.
And then, if no other claimant puts in an appearance, the state law says I hand the custody of the place over to you as the rightful heir.
I don't know what I'll do with the place. I certainly never want to see it again.
Now, let's go inside.
The door's unlocked. Well, there's nothing here for anyone to take anyway. Gloomy, isn't it?
What a ghostly effect, that light filtering down from the upstairs windows.
I remember this room to the right here. I thought so. It's empty. Wait. Come here, quick.
Huh?
What?
What is it?
What's in that far corner? I think it's a man.
It must be Grossman.
Hey, you. Hey, Tom, wait. This man's dead. Stone dead.
Why, he can't be. Rosser, kick out some of those boards so we can get some light in here.
Right.
I'll help you, Rosser.
All right.
There. He's been dead for some time. He's rigid.
There's his knife on the floor. But there's no blood on it.
Look at his hands. Palms out and those claw-like fingers shielding his face.
There's not a mark on him. See if you can help me lower his arm.
Certainly. There. Look at those wild, staring eyes and that half-open mouth. Can you figure out why he died, Tom?
This man died of sheer terror. Don't you agree, Ned?
What? Why, Ned, what's the matter? By heaven, Tom. It's Manton. Look, you saw him once at our place, didn't you?
Yes, but he wore a beard then and long hair. But you're right. This is Manton.
Manton? Grossmith was Manton? Tom, Brewer, do you see what I think I see in the thick dust?
Where?
What? There on the floor. Leading from the door straight across the room to within a yard of Manton's body.
Footprints. Bare feet. Three parallel lines of them. This is awful.
A woman's footprints in the center and on either side the marks of children's feet.
Look at that. This nearest print of the woman's foot. The middle toe is missing.
The middle toe of the right foot.
Gertrude. My sister Gertrude.
From the time-worn pages of the past, we have brought you the story, The Middle Toe of the Right Foot. Bellkeeper, pull the bell.
Tonight's presentation brings to a close the present series of Weird Circle Stories at the Ogden's Playhouse. For the past 39 weeks, we've brought you the great mystery classics by the world's master storytellers with the thought that in the entertainment offered, you would find enjoyment. If the presentation of this Weird Circle series has attained that objective, Ogden's feels that the purpose of the series has been met. Till we meet again, then, here's a reminder. Try Ogden's Fine Cut Tobacco. You'll find Ogden's easy to roll, delightful to smoke. Yes, easy to roll, delightful to smoke. If you smoke a pipe, try Ogden's Cut Plug. It's a smooth, mellow pipe tobacco.
Of the past, we have heard another immortal tale in The Weird Circle. Bellkeeper, toll the bell. Be here in this lonely cave by the restless sea once again next time.
rising inequality and growing political instability that we see today are the direct result of decades of bad economic theory.
The last five decades of trickle-down economics haven't worked. But what's the alternative?
Middle-out economics is the answer.
Because the middle class is the source of growth, not its consequence.
That's right.
This is Pitchfork Economics with Nick Hanauer, a podcast about how to build the economy from the middle out. Welcome to the show.
You know, Goldie, when I think about points of leverage in terms of shifting the kind of economy we have to the kind of economy that we want and would benefit more people in more ways, I just don't think that there's anything more important than the definition of the social purpose of the corporation. I just don't think that there's any change we could make in the structure of the economy that would reverberate more than moving from this shareholder value primacy definition that we have today to something else, some kind of stakeholder version of it, or, you know, something more evolved. Because, you know, we live in a commercial society, and like it or not, corporations, companies are the dominant sort of topological feature of the economy. And how they think about what they should do and how they should do it is an extraordinarily important thing.
And, you know, it gets to, I think, one of the core principles in the way we understand economics and understand the market, that the, you know, market competition is really important. We view it as an evolutionary system, and if you're not competing, you're not getting innovation. But it is competition between firms, between corporations, largely. The economy is largely happening inside these firms. And yeah. So it is what in evolutionary theory is called group selection or multi-level selection. It is competition between these highly cooperative groups of people, because yeah. That is what is going on within the corporation. People are cooperating, a mix of voluntary and involuntary cooperation. It depends on the company you're working for and your job and how much you like it and how much you like the people that you're working with. But for a corporation to be successful, people have to cooperate, because that's where all the value is created. That's where all the innovation comes from. That's where all the productivity comes from. Otherwise, we wouldn't have these corporations, just be a bunch of individuals fighting with each other in the market.
Right.
And it's weird that economics loses sight of this.
Yes.
That it talks about this market of producers and consumers, you know, setting prices and all that, when really most of the economy is not happening in the market. It's happening before you come to market.
Yes.
It's like viewing farming as selling vegetables in a farmer's market, when in fact most of your year is spent growing and harvesting vegetables.
That's right. Which is what makes it all the stranger and sillier that the sort of governing framework that we use for managing corporations is shareholder primacy. This idea that the only people who count are shareholders, not the community, not the employees, not the customers, nothing else. And again, I think of all the bad things that neoliberalism brought, probably nothing is worse than the issue of than this idea of shareholder primacy, that the only purpose of the corporation is to enrich shareholders. And so
to maximize value for shareholders,
yeah.
this twisted idea of yeah. what the economy is for.
So it'll be really fun today to talk to our friend Lenore Palladino, who has a new book out called Good Company, Economic Policy After Shareholder Primacy, where she discusses how to redesign corporate governance to shift power away from shareholders and towards, you know, other stakeholders like workers or the public good. Because I don't think that there's a more important, again, point of leverage available for policymakers.
I'm Lenore Palladino. I'm an associate professor of economics and public policy at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and I'm the author of Good Company, Economic Policy After Shareholder Primacy.
Let's start with, if you don't mind, defining shareholder primacy. Obviously, we have spoken about this on the podcast before, the social purpose of the corporation, but take a whack at it and let's expand from there.
Yeah. Well, first, let me just say thanks for having me. And I use so many of your podcasts in my teaching. So let me just also plug that this is such a great teaching tool for people teaching economics and public policy. So I'm happy to be here. So shareholder primacy is this idea that the purpose of the corporation is to make as much money as possible for shareholders. And it really works two ways. It's this idea that profits should flow as much as possible to shareholders and that shareholders should be in charge. And it is the law of the state of Delaware, which is where, for plenty of odd reasons, the majority of large U.S. corporations are chartered. Corporate law in the United States is state law, not federal law. And it's based on this idea that shareholders are the main group within a corporation that takes the risks. But I see it as something that really contributes to the problems we have in the U.S. of wealth inequality, of declining innovation. And so that's why I got really interested in writing about both the idea of shareholder primacy, but more concretely, policies that we could put in place that would move us away from this framework and towards a better way of operating corporations.
I'm curious, when did it become the law in Delaware, and is it different in other states?
Yeah, so it's been the law in Delaware for quite a long time, and it is, with some variation, the way that corporate charter laws are written for for-profit business corporations in most states in the U.S. We do have, of course, also other options like public benefit corporations, nonprofits, et cetera. But this is the framework that governs most for-profit businesses that are incorporating across the United States for decades and decades. But in the late 70s, 80s, as you all have talked about so many times, we had this major shift in our political economy in the United States. And we also had major shifts in terms of who were shareholders, right? We had the rise of large institutional shareholders in the form of pension funds, endowments, other major, pools of financial assets. And we had legal changes that enabled these big pools of assets to start investing in or purchasing corporate equity, whereas before they had been limited to government bonds or other more safe financial assets. So we had a lot of changes in the 80s that really gave shareholder primacy its power. And we also had a whole intellectual revolution that supported these transitions. You know, people love to talk about Milton Friedman's article in the New York Times about the purpose of the corporation is to maximize shareholder value. But we had lots of other leading academics in the law and economics movement really push this idea forward in a way that it just wasn't dominant in the post-war era in the same way.
Yeah. There's so many ways to go in this conversation, but I think let's start with the idea that shareholders are the only ones who take risk, because that's just obviously not true.
Yeah, it's a fascinating issue when you really get into the academic literature, because what they're basically saying is that a shareholder who holds a share, because in the legal process of bankruptcy, they're the last one who's going to get a claim, that they're the one who, they're the only group that takes risks. But for most of us, especially today in the 21st century, those of us holding equity in with publicly traded companies, we hold through an index fund or some other major, we buy our equities in big baskets. We don't know what companies we're even holding. We face risk if the financial markets broadly go up and down, but our risk doesn't really come from one particular company or another. In contrast, most workers hopefully have just one job. And so in my view, they're the ones actually taking the most risk in terms of what happens with any given corporation. But the way that the academic law and economics, works out who takes risks, workers are paid a fixed claim, I'm putting that in air quotes, and so they're not the ones taking any risk at all in these models. And so it's a very weird setup.
Well, yeah, it's just a setup designed to benefit owners of capital. But the other thing is that it seems intuitively true until you start to think about it. And I'm just, in my head, I'm drawing a contrast between real risk capital, which is sort of what people who start early stage companies do.
Like right? Nick.
Like me, when I write a check to a couple of people who are starting a company, I'm taking a lot of risk. Most particularly, and this is the key thing, is that if things go poorly, I can't get my money out, right? Like it's a gone.
Right.
And if you own shares in a public company, I mean, depending on how you manage yourself, you take almost no risk. Because if something bad happens, you can just sell the stock the next day.
Right.
Like you're not going to lose all your money unless you're an idiot.
Another big difference here, Nick, is that when you put money into Amazon when it was starting up, they used that money to start up Amazon. The money went to Amazon, right? When if I buy a share of Amazon, they're not getting that money.
No.
Exactly.
It means nothing to them. I'm not investing. I'm speculating that the price will go up. I'm gambling.
Right. And that's where I think that so much of the cultural misunderstanding of the purpose of the stock market is really, really important in propping up shareholder primacy. So I have another book that I'm working on right now called The Myth That Shareholders Are Always Investors. And, our laws, the way we talk about shareholders, we call them investors because, as you said, Nick, there are certain cases where, equity going into an early stage company is necessary for that company to grow, to learn how to innovate, et cetera. But for our public markets today, we call shareholders investors, but most people don't actually realize that, as you said, trading is happening on the secondary markets. That means when I buy stock, that money is never going to the company at all. It's going to the person or financial institution that sold the stock. And so this whole, our language problems, the way that you see, the Larry Finks of the world talk about the importance of shareholding and index funds to, American prosperity and innovation. We have these cultural myths that really support this legal framework that I think are also incredibly important to break down and understand.
Yeah. And I think it is true that the capital markets are a good thing. It's just not also true that everything should be subordinated to them.
Lenore, I have this argument with people all the time, and they just can't wrap their mind around it, where I say that I'm not in it. I'm not investing. I'm not investing. And for me, it's not like Nick. I mean, it's just my retirement accounts. So if I buy into a fund or I buy into a stock, that's not investing. It is speculating that things will go up.
Right. And buying for, financial asset appreciation is something necessary, these days for retirement security. It's not a bad thing in and of itself. But the problem is that, the SEC calls shareholders investors. Our laws are called the Investment Company Act, the Investment Advisors Act. And so we've just got this confusion that I think causes a lot of these issues to persist.
In your book, you talk about what makes a company good. What's your definition?
So a good company, I think, produces goods and services and reduces its negative impact on the world. It innovates through, respecting its workforce and its customers. And it doesn't fight regulation, doesn't fight, to have a sort of decent democratic political system. I also think that there are some activities that shouldn't be done by large private corporations. So I talk a little bit in the book about just sort of a caveat that, activities like education, healthcare, the basic needs we have as a society, I actually think those are better done through having either public options and large private entities or, through the public sector itself. But I think good companies essentially, what I'm focusing on in the book is private companies and you know, their focus on innovation rather than simply financial extraction.
You know, and again, people will push back to me, well, companies aren't supposed to be good. They're supposed to just make money. It's about making a profit, not about being good. And but in fact, corporations don't have natural rights. They're creations of law, and we charter them for a reason, and that is to improve the public good, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So we are, you know, in a democratic society, which I hope we remain one, in a democratic society, we give a grant of a charter to a corporation that gives that entity the legal right to exist forever, perpetual existence, and, you know, gives the shareholders and other, you know, humans who are interacting with it some protection from if it, you know, goes bankrupt or has other, you know, financial challenges. And so for companies to have these benefits, we should also have the public, you know, power, public right to regulate them. And there's a lot of, I think, talk that's maybe died down recently, but over the last 6 or 7 years about the changing, you know, purpose of the corporation towards paying attention to multiple groups of stakeholders, the Business Roundtable, the leading, you know, one of the leading corporate trade organizations in the U.S. changed its statement on the purpose of the corporation back, you know, 7 or 8 years ago to say that stakeholders matter, not, you know, including workers, customers, the natural environment. And I think that's important. But I actually think at the end of the day, corporations, it still doesn't focus enough on the actual production process, right? It's the production of goods and services and innovation over time that I think is what both the shareholder primacy framework and even the stakeholder governance framework miss. There's just a black box, you know, in the way we teach mainstream economics, even starting at the, you know, 101 level, we teach the production process as this black box. There's this mysterious alchemy by which inputs turn into outputs. And that's just been a real failing of, you know, economists and others who study the corporation. I think that has to be at the center of how we understand what is a good corporation.
It's like trying to an analogy I use. It's like trying to understand biology, the biological world without ever looking inside the cell. Like saying that the economy is all this competition between corporations when in fact that's the market. The economy, most of the economy is going on inside the corporation.
Yes,
and that
exactly.
is happening outside of the market.
That's right. Our friend Cesar Hidalgo, the physicist, says that the original sin of economics is starting with trade. Right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because
right.
all the interesting bits come before you trade.
Exactly.
It's in the making of the stuff.
Yep. Exactly. And that's what's so interesting. You know, I think that's where in some ways I get jealous sometimes of people in business and management schools because they're actually studying the guts of what's happening. You know, and this used to be a part of institutional economics in the United States. It's, you know, it's part of our historical understanding of what corporations do and what happens in the economy. But it's just been totally lost in the last 50 years.
How did that happen? How did economics get so disassociated from things like business, finance, and accounting?
You know, I think that's a great question. I don't know that I have a short answer. You know, economists clearly carved out a space for themselves of acting as if we could organize our, you know, economic life into models that had to solve for, you know, optimization so that we would find some sort of perfect equilibrium. So we left out the messy stuff, right? We left out the actual process by which things are produced. We left out the ways in which consumers actually base their decision-making around what they buy, what they need, what they want. So we just left it behind, and these other disciplines really, really took up the space.
Right.
So you use General Electric as an example in your book. Tell us about that.
It's a personal example. My grandfather, Arthur Palladino, was a worked at GE, was a factory worker at the Lynn, Massachusetts factory for many, many years after he came back from World War II. And so I grew up, you know, hearing some of those stories about what it was like to be, you know, he didn't get a college education. He didn't sort of a classic white ethnic success story, really, in that era of the 50s and 60s, when you could come from a very poor immigrant family and raise a family into the middle class through a factory job. Right. So, and then I saw in his retirement, he was one of the last sets of workers who managed to hold on to the pension that they had been promised. So GE is the paradigmatic, I think, American corporation of the 20th century. And then we saw, you know, the rise of its innovative capacities, you know, in many ways. And then we saw it really be the leading corporation in the transition to shareholder primacy with Jack Welch. And there's great, great books out there telling the story in detail, but he is the one that a lot of people credit with training a whole generation of corporate executives to stop paying attention to innovation and really push their, put their attention towards maximizing that share price at, you know, at all expenses. And we saw what happened, right? We saw what happened to the workforce at GE. We saw the disintegration of the company and its reconstitution. And I was really fascinated when the Pat Gelsinger came in to GE and, you know, said, no more buybacks. We're not going to do stock buybacks anymore. That had been, you know, one of the biggest tools of, you know, the last 20 years of GE, of keeping its stock price up. So it's just, I think, a really interesting example to tell this broader story, although certainly it's not the only company that's gone through this process.
It's a great example also just because of its long history. I mean, to go from Thomas Edison to Jack Welch. I mean, the Edison, horrible person, but certainly the icon of innovation in American history.
Jack Welch, also an awful person.
Right. So that's what they have in common. Yeah.